New Horizons is sponsored in part by the Idaho Humanities Council, deepening understanding of human experience by connecting people with ideas.
Today on New Horizons, journalist David Friedman, author of Wrong, Why Experts Keep Failing Us, and How to Know When Not to Trust Them.
Take the media out of the picture completely and just look at what gets published in respected peer-reviewed research journals. The problem is there. It's really pretty bad. And I think the important thing is to get people thinking about this, to not be trusting experts, including scientists, blindly, but to have a better understanding of how messy the process of science and expertise is. So we have really the wrong mechanisms in place to reward experts, and that is really the essence of the problem.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. From the amount of exercise our bodies need to judging the success of our investments to sports statistics, we are inundated with information. We trust the experts to get it right. Unfortunately, according to today's guest, we're more likely to be misled. In his new book, Wrong, Why Experts Keep Failing Us and How to Know When Not to Trust Them, science and business journalist David Friedman discusses the reasons why so much expert advice is eventually disproved and offers suggestions on how to spot reliable information. Mr. Friedman is a contributing editor at Inc. magazine and has written for The Atlantic, Newsweek, The New York Times, Science, Wired, and many other publications. He also has written books about the U.S. Marines, computer crime and artificial intelligence, and is the co-author of A Perfect Mess, about the useful role of disorder in daily life, business, and science. Mr. Friedman joins us today by phone from the Boston area. David Friedman, welcome to New Horizons.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Conventional wisdom is always poking fun at expert advice of one kind or another and suggesting that you don't pay attention to it because next year it's going to change and you'll get another set of advice. Could you explain to us, for starters, who these experts are? Where do they come from? How do you identify them?
Sure. I try to keep it simple in terms of defining experts because you can actually get very technical about it. There are people who do all kinds of research into what is an expert and different kinds of expertise. So I try to keep it really simple. And when I talk about experts, I'm really talking about those people who are likely to have some impact on the public. They're likely to be either quoted in newspapers or their articles in journals are perhaps likely to be read and have some impact, or you're going to see them on TV or read about them on the web. So I call these people mass experts. Now we have local experts as well. Our own doctors, our auto mechanics, our teachers are experts to some extent. But what I'm really talking about, the people who, when they say something, it can really affect a lot of lives.
How difficult is it to distinguish between the expert that is doing the research, providing the conclusions, and the journalist in the media that is reporting on it? And is there sometimes a disconnect there where perhaps the problem is more in the reporting than it is in the study?
Well, this is typically the first line of defense in expertise, which is the media has done it to us. We're actually right as experts, but then reporters get a hold of it and they mess it all up. This turns out to be absolutely not the case. The media does often do a terrible job and they make things worse. But if you take the media out of the picture completely and just look at what gets published in respected peer-reviewed research journals, the problem is there. And it's really pretty bad, right there in journals. So by the time the media adds its problems on top of that, yes, it gets a little bit worse, but it's so bad to begin with that you really can't look at this as a media problem.
But isn't the scientific method one that comes up with information that is accurate and research results that are not? And along the way, both get reported. That's the purpose of journals, to report the progress of research. And can scientists be held accountable for the fact that some reporter or media outlet is going to take it and run with it, not understanding perhaps that this is a long discovery process that isn't necessarily finished?
Now, that's a very, very interesting and I think extremely important point, which is that when a researcher publishes a finding in the journal, that researcher knows, and other researchers in the community know, that this is the product of a very messy process, that all kinds of distortions and errors and assumptions and analytical tricks have taken place to get a certain result. And people in the community often, in the research community, often don't take each other's results all that seriously for that reason. They find them interesting. They may be impressed by them. It might be something to build upon or look into, but it's rarely regarded as the answer to anything. And that is not clear, though, to a lay person or typically a reporter in the press who looks at one of these journal articles, because it really does look like the researcher has come up with a conclusion, a finding that's being held up as scientific truth. So absolutely something gets lost in the picture. And one thing I've suggested is perhaps all media reports, all journal articles as well, should come with some sort of warning label, sort of like the kind we see on a cigarette pack, saying that this finding is not to be taken as anything even approximating the truth. It's simply a sort of a shot in the dark in what is likely to be a long, messy process in stumbling towards the truth eventually. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's perfectly in keeping with the scientific process. But the public doesn't get that. And something has to be done, I think, to let the public understand that.
Why don't you give us some recent examples where the experts have really got it wrong?
Sure. Well, we all pretty much got bitten by the wrongness in all the financial experts. How many of us were really warned that our real estate was grossly overvalued, that banks were at risk, that our savings were at risk, our pensions were about to be devastated, that the economy was sort of teetering on the edge of a black hole. We came very close to, I think most people agree, we came fairly close to triggering a worldwide global depression. We managed to barely miss that. So that's a pretty big one. Now, I like to focus for various reasons on medical findings. I think that's really the most interesting and stark example. But lately, we've heard a lot about vitamin D. Now, this has gone back and forth forever, but it's really a big deal. I take a lot of vitamin D. I think a lot of people are now. And we've been told for a long time that this is protective against cancer risk. It will lower our risk of getting many types of cancer. Now the pendulum seems to be swinging back the other way, and it turns out that vitamin D may not be of much help at all. And you know, a lot of us really worry about cancer. I think it's a really big deal, and this kind of thing can be very upsetting and frustrating to a lot of people.
Well, what about the daily dose of aspirin while we're on the medical advice? I think you might have mentioned that in your book, or I read some commentary about it. And as a matter of fact, I might add, just since reading your book, a week or so ago, another study came out that said the daily aspirin protects against a number of cancers, especially colon cancer. They always warn, of course, that there will be some people whose stomachs can't tolerate this stuff, and you could have some serious side effects as a result of it. But where do you put something as simple as the daily aspirin regimen in this argument of whether experts are right or wrong?
Well, this is one of those cases, and it's often true, that as soon as you ask the question, you get into trouble. And the question's a perfectly reasonable one. What's the deal here? Is aspirin going to help or not? And that question just, it can't possibly be answered in a simple way, and that's really the essence of the trouble here. These are complex questions. Now, in the case of aspirin, there's an enormous complicating factor, which is, although it does seem to be, for many, probably most people, somewhat protective against cardiovascular disease and possibly against some types of cancer for some people, it also can significantly raise your risk of bleeding out at some point, of some sort of potentially fatal gastrointestinal disorder. And the two tend to pretty much balance out for most people. On average, an aspirin a day is as likely to kill you as save your life. And what it comes down to is, which one do you want to worry about more, getting some sort of bleeding ulcer or dying of a stroke. And it's really up to you and your doctor to decide how to balance those risks. And in the end, everybody has to talk to their doctor. And I hope everybody has a doctor that will talk to them and that they trust. So I can't answer that question. No one really can answer that question. And when we look for a simple answer to a simple question, will a daily aspirin help me or not, we're doomed to be misled, because no matter what you're told, it's likely to be a somewhat distorted wrong answer.
You know, David, this program airs on Friday night drive time, people going home from work, and I hear from many doctors that they listen to this show, and I think some of them just drove off the road knowing that there's this amount of concern and that it's as likely to do harm as to do good. But you make the point that patients need to consult with their doctors on this, and that's where the answers to these issues, I guess, lie.
Yes.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the National Football League. I can't believe there's anything in the National Football League statistics or expertise that would be wrong, but you make an interesting point in your book.
Yes. We certainly think that, we picture during the NFL draft, I mean, here you have the collective wisdom, the best and the brightest certainly in professional football and possibly in all of sports, because so much money is at stake. I think this is a multi-billion dollar, essentially, draft. And the future of teams and everything that means is at stake here. And so we expect a certain minimal, at least, amount of expertise to be applied to that process. And yet, if you look at how successful the various coaches and managers and scouts are at predicting which college players are going to do well in the NFL, it's surprisingly bad. And some of the examples are striking. And in my book, I go into some detail. And to some extent, I should thank my editor for this, who actually turned me on to this example. But Tom Brady of the New England Patriots, clearly one of the most successful by almost any measure, if not the most successful quarterback in history, and one of the most impactful players in history, actually, he had a pretty outstanding record as a college player, and he nearly went undrafted. Almost no team wanted anything to do with him at any round in the NFL draft. The Patriots happened to get an extra pick at the end of the draft, and they used it on him, and they promptly benched him. And he only played after a year because of an injury. And he went on the field and immediately led the team to a touchdown, and of course no one's looked back since. And he's not the only example. There are others, several striking examples. So even in football, even where you have all these statistics from college, where you can actually look at how well people do, and experts still get it wrong.
Well, I've got an idea for a second edition if you want to stay on sports for a minute. The BCS rankings are determined in part by computer rankings, and I don't know whether you saw it, but just a week or so ago, they got it wrong. They inputted the wrong data, and four teams were misranked in the end-of-the-season BCS polls. So there's a little subject you can wrestle with.
And I think that's important. That's a very good example, because what happens is when we see numbers and we know something is data-driven, we think it's better information, we think it's wiser, we think we can't go wrong if we're paying attention to the numbers. In fact, numbers can cause more problems than they solve sometimes, and that's a very good example, just simple errors in numbers. And it turns out there were some famous scientific studies that were thrown off simply by getting the numbers wrong. People plugged them in wrong, or they read them wrong, or they interpreted them wrong. And these caused some real problems. I mean, the very famous breast cancer study was thrown off. That turned out to be partly because somebody put in numbers fraudulently. And a lot of women made decisions, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of women made decisions about mastectomies in part based on the results of that study, which just had wrong numbers in it. It's really sometimes quite frightening.
You've pointed out that has a lot to do with the pressure to produce research results. Could you expand on that?
This is really the single most important point I have to make, which is that in the end, people will do what they're rewarded to do. Not only is that professionally true, it's essential to human nature. Even more than that, it's built into all organisms. All organisms of all type, from bacteria on up, all the way to the smartest human beings, we're all programmed essentially to make sure that those behaviors that get us certain kinds of rewards will be repeated, and those behaviors that get us punished or unrewarded will not be repeated. And in the case of scientists and other kinds of experts, there are certain types of expertise they can produce that will get them stature, that will get them promotions, that will get them listened to, that will get them respect from their peers, and they'll get published, and they'll get better jobs and tenure, and their lives will in many ways be much, much better. So what happens? Well, what happens is they go ahead and they produce that sort of expertise. Being right has absolutely nothing to do with it. There really are no mechanisms in the world to make sure that people who give the right answers end up doing better than people who give certain types of answers. Now, what are those certain types of answers that get scientists and other type of experts rewarded? Well, they tend to be breakthrough findings. They discover that something new works and helps people, and we didn't know about this before. And these are the exciting breakthrough findings we read about in the newspaper. It's what journals want to publish as well. And when you're responsible for one of these exciting breakthrough findings, your career is going to skyrocket. So what happens is scientists, whether consciously or unconsciously, they find ways to come up with these findings, these breakthrough, novel, exciting findings. Except it turns out, and it's very easy to prove this, that these are the findings most likely to be wrong. And we see this happening again and again and again. And so we have really the wrong mechanisms in place to reward experts. And that is really the essence of the problem.
You're listening to David Friedman. He's the author of Wrong, Why Experts Keep Failing Us and How to Know When Not to Trust Them. Who's complicit in what you've just described? I mean, I can think of the National Science Foundation, the National Institute of Health, the Department of Energy, the Department of Defense. Those are all agencies that I know Boise State University researchers go to when they're trying to get funded in some research endeavor. What role do these agencies play? What role can they play in perhaps tightening things up in these areas? And have you heard from any of them since your book's been out?
I've spoken to people in a number of different agencies, and in general, I have to say it's really been shocking. I've been completely floored by how positive the people within the scientific infrastructure have been in acknowledging these problems and being quite essentially thanking me and in some ways. Saying that they feel a little relieved that this stuff is coming. I mean, this is stuff that either they've explicitly known for a long time or have suspected or at some level have been aware of this. And they really have not been interested in hiding it. It's just that no one has really brought it to the public's attention much, with some exceptions. And they feel good about it. They want to fix the problem. They do. And so in terms of who gets blamed, I think we all take the blame. Every one of us in all steps of what I call the expertise cycle, including those of us in the public who consume this expertise, we're all to blame. But in terms of what the funding agencies can do, is I think that whole infrastructure needs to be rearranged so that more emphasis is placed on getting money to researchers based on how likely it is that their work is going to hold up and contribute over the long run, instead of funding those scientists who are most likely to come out with exciting breakthrough findings or who simply continue on a certain line of research because it looks like good science and results in a lot of publishable papers. So we see this, for example, in genetics, where it's easy to do very clean science to get a lot of publishable papers. We know how to find a gene that's linked to a certain disorder. We can genetically engineer mice to really focus in and zoom in on a certain gene, and then we can try to use different compounds to see how we can affect that gene, and these might be drugs. And this is a whole industry in science, and billions of dollars go into it. What are the results? Almost nothing nothing that's been helpful. There have been essentially no drugs that have come out of this process. And yet, because it's clean science, it gets a lot of publishable papers, it gets a ton of funding. And I think a lot of that funding should be redirected in ways that will actually improve people's health.
Well, you seem to be a committee of one when it comes to the studying the experts. I guess I have to ask the question, are there others like you who are watching, keeping track of this, either informally through the media or formally through government? What can we count on out there to give us better information?
Well, there have been people out there within a few researchers and scientists who have been tracking some of these problems. And I didn't contribute any original data to the picture. I basically, in my book, is what I did was I went out and found all these so-called meta-experts in other field experts who what they're expert in is looking at the problems with expertise, and especially in science. That was my main interest. I don't think of myself as being any sort of nexus of what's happening here. Hopefully, I helped in some small way bring the discussion to the public. And I think when the public gets involved, that's when it will start to feed back into the other infrastructures that really need change. When we start demanding better forms of expertise, I think we'll start getting it.
To the extent that you're the expert on the experts, and to the extent that much of your examples in the book are anecdotal, maybe that's not the fairest way of characterizing it. I'll let you correct me in your answer. How can we count on you or someone like you? Do we need a more objective approach to this issue than just reading about examples when there are millions of experiments going on as we speak in laboratories across the planet? And you found a few that work for your argument. Could somebody write a book and find plenty more that work for the opposite argument?
Yes. And in fact, I you're right. I have a chapter in the book, which is it's called Is This Book Wrong?, where I basically point out, I sort of beat everybody else to the punch. And I go, look, you know, if experts are wrong and I'm sort of playing expert here, then I must be wrong, too. And this is a very naughty problem. And the answer is absolutely nobody should take my word for anything. Now, I did try to not rely on anecdote in the book. I love anecdotes. People love stories. And I do have some in the book. But for the most part, I tried to rely on data, the data that other experts have put together, surveys and counting articles and analyzing data in the field. So there's really most of my arguments are, in fact, based on data and based on the very same sorts of techniques that researchers use in all their studies. But, of course, that raises the question, well, if there's so many problems with studies, then why are the studies of studies any more to be believed? So you can really go kind of nuts trying to deal with that problem. And what I say is there's no simple answer to this. I mean, maybe the truth is somewhere in between. Obviously, there's some problem here. Obviously, we can do better. And I think the important thing is to provoke discussion, to get people thinking about this, to not be trusting experts, including scientists, blindly, but to have a better understanding of how messy the process of science and expertise is, so we can all try to make somewhat better decisions. So nobody has to take my word for anything to recognize that there's something going on here, and we can improve the way we use expertise in the world.
Has anyone used your book to aid and abet those who question climate change?
Yes, my book has been quoted, and I've been interviewed on the subject by people on all sides of the issue. It's interesting, of course. Everybody who has a strongly held opinion about anything always believes that they're looking at the picture correctly, and all these other fools aren't seeing the truth. And so if I come out and say there's a lot of trouble with expertise, then pretty much everybody on any side of any issue says, see, I told you those other idiots didn't know what they were talking about. Obviously, my argument can be used by anybody to argue anything. The fact of the matter is, The one thing I'm trying to say, probably more clear than anything in terms of who's right and who's wrong on any issue, including climate change, is let's be really careful before we get really sure that we know what we're talking about. And what I say about climate change is because it's a consensus that's been slowly building for many, many years, it's the most reliable kind of consensus. It's the sort of expertise that's most likely to be right. So I do believe in climate change. However, I think that just because there's a pretty strong consensus of researchers who believe in it, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily right. Many, many times throughout history, a strong consensus of scientists and other experts building over many years has turned out to be wrong. And they could be wrong in this case, too. So I believe in climate change, but I'm not as sure as many other people seem to be in it.
Well, you mentioned the strong consensus. That gets me to that part of your book where you do try to help the reader identify expert advice in our daily lives that works better than that kind of expertise that you would be critical of. Could you help us understand what to look for when we either read an article or hear or see something on television and radio that has some remarkable conclusion attached to it? What should we dig down to look for to come up with a take on whether or not this is really something to believe in or reject as first stage of a scientific method that has a long way to go?
I do try to offer some advice along those lines, and I think we can all do better. I think there actually are some, I hate to call them rules, but I think there are some guidelines for increasing the chances that we won't be taken in by the worst sort of expert advice, and that we will put more of our belief, of our resources, into considering that advice that has a higher chance of being right. I call the chapter 11 Simple Never Fail Rules for Not Being Misled by Experts. Let me just say right here, that's a joke. I thought everybody would get it, but a lot of people didn't, because I spent a lot of time in the book, including in this chapter, talking about why lists of rules tend to be the worst kind of expertise, why nothing is never fail, and simple advice tends to be the worst advice. But let me quickly sketch these out. For one thing, I tell people you should pay the least attention to exciting breakthrough findings. Even if you read about them, big headlines in the New York Times, opening story on the Today Show, that's the stuff that's most likely to turn out to be wrong for some of the reasons we've already spoken about. And on the other hand, at the other end of this spectrum, if you look for sort of that less spectacular, more boring sort of wisdom that has emerged over a period of many, many years and has been building a consensus among leading experts, that kind of stuff, even though it doesn't get headlines, it sort of seeps into our consciousness over time, that kind of stuff tends to be far more likely to be right. I make a simple statement, which is you can probably ignore most advice about nutrition and about taking supplements and about what lifestyle is likely to keep you most healthy, because that turns out to be just so incredibly complex, the way what you eat affects you and your various lifestyles, where you live, things like sibling order. I mean, these kinds of things have very, very complicated effects that science isn't anywhere even close to pinning down. So when someone says, eat this and you will lose weight or you will be healthy, that kind of stuff is almost always wrong, or at least not that helpful.
Well, David, we've run out of time, but I do want to alert our readers to the fact that you have some really interesting appendices to this book, a sampling of contemporary high-powered scientific fraud, a tiny sampling of expert wrongness, conflict, and confusion. I'm going to leave that to the readers to read when they pick up their copy of your book, Wrong, Why Experts Keep Failing Us and How to Know When Not to Trust Them. David Friedman, thanks so much for joining us today on New Horizons.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons. Before I sign off, let me take a moment to remind our listeners that in January, New Horizons will become Reader's Corner, a name that reflects our focus on authors and their books. Please join me in 2011 for Reader's Corner, Friday at 5:30 and Sunday morning at 11 on KBSX 91.5.